Hey, this is an interview for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program dealing with the Youngstown community, the Youngstown Jewish community, and specifically the Rabbi Sidney Berkowitz. The interviewee is Dr. Stephen Schildkraut. The interview is taking place at his residence at 2201 Goleta Avenue, Youngstown, Ohio. The time is approximately 9:30 on July 3rd now, 1992. The interviewer is Matthew Butts. Okay, Dr. Schildkraut, could you tell me a little bit about yourself as far as your childhood, your education?
Okay, childhood was primarily in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. I moved there with my family at age 5. Went to public schools, elementary school on the north side, then on the south side. Mm-hmm. High school on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. College at University of Chicago. When I started college, my family actually moved out of the city for mm-hmm. a few years to Wilmington, Delaware, so I was living away from home but in a familiar city, mm-hmm. an unusual situation. I have two younger sisters, Carol, who is 4 years younger than I am, and Deborah, who is 8 years younger than I am. They weren't that close in age to me, but still enough that I had some time living at home with them, although a lot actually was, we lived at home separately, I guess, because of our age differences. Mm-hmm. When I graduated University of Chicago, this was with a degree in chemistry, Bachelor mm-hmm. of Science degree. Right after graduation, I got married to Tony, and we then moved to the north side of the city, had an apartment. She was working as a pharmacist after, first going to school in pharmacy school at the University of Illinois in Chicago at the Medical Center, and then working as a pharmacist in downtown Chicago, and I was attending Northwestern University graduate program in chemistry. And so we both commuted. I went north to school, she went south to work, and we kind of lived in between on the, mm-hmm. the northern border of the city, right between Evanston and Chicago. My interest had been in sciences, mathematics, and actually decided to major in chemistry. I guess it was my junior year of college, and had some research experience in my senior year, which I wanted to pursue further, and with that background, I was able to get a research assistantship at Northwestern University, working in physical chemistry, a field called mass spectrometry, which in fact I still do at Youngstown now. I was at Northwestern about a little over 3 years, and finished the PhD work at that point, having finished up a thesis. Then, anticipating that I would want to try to get some kind of academic work, I got a postdoctoral appointment. This was required then because pretty much anybody in the sciences who wanted to do academic teaching had to have not just a PhD but also postdoctoral research experience. So I inquired about a position at Rice University in Houston and went down there right after I finished up my PhD work. That was 1968, January, so Tony and I moved down there. Very soon after that, our first son, Doug, was born in May of 68, and then about a year later, I started looking for academic work. Actually, I got a call from Youngstown State University from the chemistry department. I think it was about June of 69 that they had recently acquired a mass spectrometer, a fairly complex, expensive instrument. They were looking for somebody to specialize in that area of research. So Howard Meddy in the chemistry department had heard of my research director in Houston as a fairly well-known mass spectrometrist, so called his office to see if he had any students who were looking for work at that time, and he mentioned me as being a possibility, so I was invited up for an interview. Lee Rand was chairman of the chemistry department at that time. This was right after the university had become a state university, so there was quite a bit of expansion going on. A lot of hiring of new faculty. So sort of a baby boom of faculty members at that point, and I was part of that, and came up in the fall of 69 to begin teaching there. So that was my first permanent job. The postdoctoral appointment at Houston was intended just as a temporary, essentially almost a two-year position, paid for by grant money. Here was the first permanent job that we had, that I had. So we moved up. We rented an apartment in Austintown for the first year because we hadn't really been familiar with Youngstown at all very much. It was just a stop along the turnpike as far as we knew. Before that, since I had a bit of family in New York previously and we were living in Chicago, we would often drive from Chicago to New York and back, and Youngstown was a good stopping place halfway along the way. So we just knew it as a dot on the map, but I hadn't really seen the city, but we looked like a good opportunity. There was money available for the instrumentation for starting up the research. The university was growing, and so we were excited about starting the job here. The following, I guess it was almost spring in March, our second son, Jordan, was born. Just before that, we had then moved to where we are right now in Goleta. Mm-hmm. After spending a year renting, we realized we wanted to stay on the north side of the city to be convenient to the university. We liked the neighborhood. We had always liked living in cities. Having come from Chicago, we lived in cities and felt we preferred that type of a situation rather than rural or even suburban living, which a lot of other people around here do. Mm-hmm. So I've been at the department since that time, really one job, just moving up through the ranks. Mm-hmm. Let's see, what else would be useful to know about me? I suppose most of my time, my efforts are towards work, mm-hmm. Different aspects of it, the teaching aspect, the research aspect of it, getting involved to some extent in university affairs, committees, that sort of thing, some involvement with the NeoCom program, the medical school program, mm-hmm. here that the chemistry department's involved in. So I've done some work on that in terms of teaching the courses, being on the admissions committee, miscellaneous other things involving curriculum matters, kind of just enjoying the diversity of the job, a lot of different aspects to it that always allow for variety. It's always changing, and I think I enjoy that. The challenge of the research, the challenge of the teaching at all different levels, from freshmen level courses to graduate courses, mm-hmm. since we do have a master's program in chemistry. And I've been involved a bit in curriculum matters there, teaching a lot of the courses in the graduate program, a member of the graduate faculty. I've been fortunate enough to have some research professorships, mm-hmm. which give me some extra time to do research, which I have pursued again with the mass spectrometer aspect, studying fundamental chemical reactions, getting at an understanding of what makes molecules do what they do. Mm-hmm. That sort of interests me, the theoretical aspect of that. In the community, we've been involved, of course, through the, with the congregation, mm-hmm. Rodeo Shalom. I'm not sure if this is relevant to the question that you asked, but I can give you a little history of our family's involvement there. Okay. We joined about the time that that Doug was getting into school, our oldest son, as part of the religious school, mm-hmm. Primarily for that reason, because in the past I had really not been religiously affiliated at all. Growing up in Chicago, and even first moving to Youngstown, I had never belonged to a congregation before. Mm-hmm. My parents were not observant in terms of religion. My father's an atheist. My mother, I'm not really sure. She never really expressed much of a view there, mm-hmm. but I think certainly not religiously observant. And myself, I kind of border between atheism and agnosticism myself, and mm-hmm. have a Oh, probably just an inherent distrust of organized religion, actually. My bringing up, my upbringing, I should say, in Chicago did involve some education in the sense of Judaism from the point of view not of religion, but of history, culture, values, ethics, these sorts of things. And I did attend a religious school, again going back to the childhood again here, on the south side of Chicago through my grade school and high school years. I had a confirmation from the school, but it was not associated with a temple or any organized religion. It was really a secular secular school, they call it, a Jewish secular school, the South Side School of Jewish Studies, it was called. They actually met in a YMCA. They didn't have their own building. Tony also, my wife, although she had been a member of a congregation, I'll let her tell you more about that later, she really had not been extremely observant in terms of the rituals or attending services on a regular basis. And we felt for the children, too, when we had to make the decision about our own kids, how should they be brought up? We certainly wanted them to have a Jewish identity, to realize what that meant, to have a knowledge of their background, their roots, and this sort of thing. Youngstown, being a much smaller Jewish community than Chicago, didn't and still doesn't have the variety of choices in terms of what type of congregation you go to, whether it's conservative or reform or orthodox or, well, we have those choices here, but we don't have choices such as secularism, these sorts of things that we had in Chicago. So that, I think, motivated us to join Rodov Shalom as the only reform congregation in the area. Actually, it's a compromise. We felt, well, you know, we'll tolerate the religious training. Wasn't essential for us, but we felt the advantage would be to get the education that we wanted the kids to have. So as I said, we joined the congregation, I guess it was 1973 or 74, I'm not sure of the exact date here, when Doug started school. And we've been members since then. Both children have gone through the religious school program, both have been bar mitzvah, both have been confirmed. The children are now off on their own. We've still felt, though, that we should maintain the affiliation just as a means of support for the Jewish community, because of friendships that we've made within the temple. But again, my feeling, and I think Tony's as well, is that it's really part of a community activity, as much as we do with it, rather than a religious fulfillment. This is how I view it. I've been fortunate so far, maybe not needing some of the services that a religious organization provides, such as times of bereavement and this sort of thing. My parents are both still living. I've had nobody in my immediate family pass away yet, other than grandparents quite a long time ago. When that happens, maybe I'll change my views about what kind of religious identification I might need, but at this point, I think we see it as really just a community activity, but not for spiritual or religious purposes. I mean, that's my point of view. I don't consider myself a religious or observant person. I have certainly values I think are important, many of them similar to the values of Reformed Jews, and for that reason I think I associate with the congregation.
When you came to the city of Youngstown, what was different about it then than it is today? What did it physically look like?
Okay, well, I think physically it was actually in much worse shape than now. 1969, it was still very much heavily industrialized. Steel was, of course, still the big industry in town. A lot of the, well, steel was a very big employer. A lot of the people here were associated with the steel industry. Physically, this meant also it was dirty, a lot of pollution. I recall in the summer when you'd open the windows in the house, you know, every day there would be the black grit on the windowsills that needed to be wiped up. There were often odors in the air, smoke in the air, not a very clean city at all. Very little in terms of cultural opportunities, not too much to do. We found ourselves very often going to Pittsburgh or Cleveland, to go to a museum, to go to a zoo, to go to a concert. Again, part of this was our background coming from Chicago, and I should have said even before that, I guess I did mention my parents had come from New York, and we had often gone back to New York to visit there, so I was familiar with New York City, very familiar with Chicago. We lived in Houston right before coming here, so we had been to several, you know, and really spent all our lives in big cities, and Youngstown was the smallest city we had lived in. And that was an adjustment to try to make that change, and as I said, one reason we wanted to live in the city was to try to keep some kind of contact with that. We like you know, being among other people and near facilities, near shopping, near educational facilities, near cultural activities. So it was a difficult adjustment at first, but I think we found our time taken up quite a lot with the raising of the children, since you know, we had very young children when we first arrived. But we felt it very important for their education, too, that we take them out to the zoos and museums and so on, so they would get an experience beyond Youngstown, because Youngstown itself, I think, was really very limited. We found an attitude here that was a very parochial sort of thing. And again, you asked about comparing it with today. I don't think it's as bad now as it was then, where I think now people are looking out of the community. There's more leaving and coming of people. And I think when we came, outsiders were fairly rare. The fact that we came from outside the city, we didn't have any family in the city. We weren't born here. We were really very unusual in Youngstown because so many people were here because their families had always been here, or they, you know, generations had worked in steel or worked at whatever it was. And I think I was sort of surprised at the you know, the depth of the roots that a lot of people had in Youngstown, having come from a larger city myself, where people keep their anonymity much more in a city like Chicago. You might know the people in your neighborhood, but people move around. They move even if it's just from one side of the city to the other side, and you don't, you know, maintain those roots for many generations. Even living in Chicago, my parents had themselves come from New York, so, you know, my family, as far as I knew, had hardly ever stayed in one city for more than a generation. So we were sort of the gypsies there, and therefore, I didn't think anything of it when I, you know, left Chicago to come to Youngstown. Well, I was in a job that required relocating. Tony was a pharmacist, which was fairly easy to relocate to, so, you know, she eventually began working here as a pharmacist as well. So moving around, going to new cities, this is something that to me seemed quite natural, and Youngstowners very often, I think, saw that as quite unusual. And again, there wasn't a lot of, I should say, the people that we met here, many of them had been here quite a long time, and so I think maybe we were a curiosity. But comparing it to nowadays, I think especially because of the influence of the university, maybe because of the influence of the hospitals bringing in professional people from outside the city, that there's much more of this mixing. I think Youngstown has acquired a lot of the amenities of a city now that it didn't have in 1969. The improvement of the museums, the Butler Institute, the Symphony improved, I think it's improved quite a bit since then, the Mill Creek Park being even more developed, I think in a good sense. I don't think it's been bad as some people think it has. The cleaning up of the environment, I think, is a big benefit. Certainly it's a much cleaner city. I think it's a much nicer looking city, in spite of the economic problems that it's had. This is unfortunate that there's been a population loss, that there's still poverty in the city, but in terms of our point of view, we're fortunate enough to have, I have to have a job that's moderately secure, at least I think so. So although there are problems around this, I think overall the city has improved, really, from our point of view. It was a very good place to raise children. Mm-hmm. I think it had many of the advantages of a large city, or at least nearby large cities. Mm-hmm. We still go to Cleveland and Pittsburgh, or Chicago, even, or New York, or wherever for vacations. We enjoy doing that, but I think still it's what Youngstown doesn't have, it's not too far from Youngstown to get these things. Well, the university, I guess maybe that's one aspect of your question, how that's changed. I think, again, the university has matured quite a bit. The big growth that occurred when I came has finished. It's been leveling, or maybe even dropping slightly, especially this past year. Obviously going to be some cutbacks, but I think it's good to see the development of the university, how that's progressed, at least in chemistry. I think we certainly improved the department. A lot of good people have been brought in. Good research is beginning. I think it's frustrating that we can't go a little further. We were hoping to get a doctoral program in chemistry. The university is just beginning this now in the School of Education. I hope with the new president, I hope he's promising a renewed emphasis on academics, that the university will progress even further along these lines. Something I would like to see. One thing to look forward to.
Physically, what did the university look like when you first arrived?
Okay, well, it was pretty much a mix of buildings. The area, the geographic area, was a bit smaller than it is now, of course. Some of the buildings were, you know, are still there that I remembered. Jones Hall, obviously, the first one at the university. Ward Beecher, where I do all my work, was there when I arrived, pretty much in its present form, although it's undergone some renovations and some expansion during the time I've been there. Kilcawley Center, I think, had been built fairly recently. I think these were built just maybe a couple of years before I had arrived. But a lot of the buildings were the old mansions. I remember the president had a house right near Ward Beecher is now, I think, where the current library is standing. There was Ford Hall, I believe it was, which had offices where the present library is. The library was in what now is Todd Hall. I guess Ward Beecher and the library were probably two most important buildings, and so there hasn't been a lot of change there. As I said, Ward Beecher really the same. Library having moved into its newer structure, much more comfortable, much easier to get around. The campus core, of course, is a big change. We had Bryson Street used to run right alongside Ward Beecher Hall, just to the west of the building. And I remember teaching classes in Ward Beecher and having the street just outside. We'd get the traffic noises coming into the building in the warm weather when the motorcyclists would race their motors up and down Bryson Street. Sometimes we had to lecture very loudly to get over the sound of the motorcycles. Now the street's been closed off. Now it's lawn and sidewalk, and I think much more pleasant there. Again, that you asked about the physical appearances of the city. I think the campus is a very good example there of the improvement in the environment. It was strictly an urban campus before. There were city streets. There were houses mixed in with campus buildings. There was traffic. It was really a congested sort of campus. And I think now getting the traffic out of this campus core, landscaping is beautiful. Everybody says this, and I agree too, that it's like working in a park. It's you've got lawns, you have hills, you have flowers. Some of this may be cut back now with the budget crunch, but still it's a beautiful place to work in terms of the physical surroundings. Very pleasant to be able to eat a lunch outside on the sitting on a bench in the nice weather, or just walking around campus. I enjoy riding a bicycle to campus. This is one reason we live here on the north side. We're just 2 miles from campus, and since 1970, when we first moved to Goleta, I've had, in fact, the same bicycle. Still running, more or less. It's not quite as good as it was, but I guess neither am I. But still, I can get to and from campus on the bike, so I enjoy it for the exercise. It's one of the things I enjoy is trying to keep physically active, because in an academic job, it's not itself physically demanding, usually, except maybe standing on your feet and talking for a couple hours. But so I try to keep active by biking. It avoids parking problems. I like to avoid stress. And again, maybe that's an aspect of my personality. I can avoid stress by riding a bike, because it's peaceful, it's quiet. I don't have to worry about fighting for a parking place. I always know I can park it right in front of the door to Ward Beecher. I can come and go whenever I want. I don't have to worry about a bus schedule or about coordinating with my wife or who takes the car, or when we had the kids, who takes the car when they were driving. Good exercise besides that. Another aspect of the facilities that brings to mind, Beegley Center, I think was not really, I can't remember whether it was there when I first started. I don't think, I know the swimming pool was not open yet in 69. I think that came a few years later, and since they opened the swimming pool, I've been a regular swimmer down there at least twice a week, going in and doing 1,000 yards typically each time I do that now. So that's my aerobic exercise, that and the bicycling. Certainly enjoy that, and it's wonderful to have a job where you can take off in the middle of the day, go swimming, come back, continue working. Mm-hmm. Nice way to relax, to get away from things, to be alone. I like solitude a lot, maybe because teaching, you're with a class, you're with a lot of people, you're communicating with students, which I enjoy, but then when I'm not doing that, I like the loneliness maybe of swimming, loneliness of riding a bicycle.
When you arrived at Youngstown State, I've done a little bit of research with the anti-war movement. Was there much of an anti-war movement at the university?
Not very much, certainly compared to what was going on in the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Youngstown had very little. It used to be the joke, and maybe still the case, that Youngstown was always 10 years behind the rest of the country, whatever it was, whether it was economics or styles or culture or even politics, perhaps. I have been involved with the movement myself as a student at the University of Chicago. I have been a member of a peace organization. Not so much anti-war. This was in the early 60s, really before the Vietnam War had become very well known. It was just little nothing, but I was just opposing the whole move towards militarism, spending so much of the federal budget on build-up of the arms race. That's what we were concerned about, the nuclear weapon build-up. So that was my first real involvement in politics there, which I guess I sort of developed the feelings in high school, and then continued it fairly actively in college. I was involved in the organizations. I was involved in anti-nuclear weapon demonstrations, downtown Chicago, this sort of thing, did picketing, the whole thing. When the Vietnam War began, at that time I was at Northwestern, and there was quite a bit of activity there, teach-ins, protesting, anti-draft protesting. It wasn't really planning, I think it was just fortune that I was married at the time, married in 64, before the really big buildup of the war, and at that time, married men were deferred from the draft. So I personally did not have to make the choice, am I going to go or not, because then that deferment sort of kept me off the prime list. And then by the time I think they started calling the married men. Tony was already pregnant at that point, and then that sort of got me a little bit of a deferment then, too, because then fathers or fathers-to-be were deferred. There are all the different classifications, and, a student deferment also came in as well. Then graduate students, people who were working towards a degree, especially in areas that were considered to be important to the defense of the country, and science was considered to be so, then that got me deferments, although I registered for the draft as legally required. I didn't really have to worry too much about that, although just before the before we left Chicago, I did get a call-up notice to come downtown Chicago for a physical, and with quite a bit of fear in mind. Again, always thinking, well, I always have a choice. Even if I'm accepted, I don't have to go. I can always go to jail, which I think for a while was seriously thinking of, because I felt very strongly that the, you know, the war in general, I think, is wrong, and this particular war especially was wrong, which I still believe. As it turned out, I didn't pass the physical anyway. So again, the great moral decision was put off beyond my own control, since I had hypertension, high blood pressure, and high heart rate, which is one reason I keep exercising. Doctors advise me, say it's really not a problem as long as I stay physically active, and I've lived so far and not had any heart problems, so I guess it's okay. Doctors tell me I'm fine, but conveniently it avoided the draft problem for me, I suppose. But getting back to your question, then coming to Youngstown, I again found the city being fairly conservative politically. Maybe not a lot of awareness of what was going on, although I'm sure the individuals who were involved, those who were drafted or who were the family members of those, certainly were aware of it. But I don't think there was a lot of real anti-war protest until probably the Kent State shootings in 1970, and that, I think, really triggered everything in this area, because it was so close to Youngstown geographically that I think people finally saw that this was a pretty important issue. Obviously, Kent State was much more involved in protest than Youngstown was. I don't think we ever had anything like what was going on there. A lot of the faculty members, I think, were very much anti-war. I was myself, although not excessively vocal about it, but certainly I talked to anybody who wanted to hear my views, not in any organized way, necessarily. And quite a few other faculty, I think, who were very much opposed to the war as well. Again, many of them from out of town, perhaps. Maybe that's why they had this this viewpoint, because I think in the big cities, obviously Berkeley, California, you know, famous for what was going on there, you know, the larger campuses, the more mature campuses, you might say, where there are residential students who I think tend to be more politically active, that's where you saw a lot of the protests. Here the students were, and to a large extent still are, commuter students. They work at a job. Being a student is just a part-time thing for them. They live with their family, whether it's parents or their own spouses and children. So they have, you might say, real lives besides just being students. And I think to that extent it limits how politically involved they can get, because they don't have that reinforcement from their peers. They're concerned with getting on with their own lives, with making a living. And that, unfortunately, I think limits political activity. I think people who get too tied up with their own lives miss out on an important aspect of life, and that is being concerned about issues and doing something about it and expressing views on politics. So it was, I think, only really after the Kent shootings that we started to see any kind of rallies or organized protest on campus. As I recall, I don't think it ever really got to the point of any violence, certainly not like Berkeley or Kent, but we did our little bit here.
It's interesting, the reason I brought up the anti-war movement, I did a research paper on it at Youngstown State, and do you remember Rabbi Berkowitz being on campus after the Kent shootings trying to calm the student population?
I can't specifically recall that, no. That was, well, before we had joined the temple, probably before I really knew him at all. And so it didn't, no, I can't recall specifically that happened. I do know he was very much involved with community activities, with political issues, but I can't recall that specifically.
Do you remember some of the political activities that he was very involved in?
Well, again, as I recall, and a lot of this was not from my direct knowledge, but just what I heard people saying about him or what I might remember reading in, in the Vindicator, I think a big part of what he was interested in was Jewish-Christian relations, trying to represent the Jewish community in the community at large, feeling that he wanted it to be understood, to be accepted. This is really, I think, a big part of the reform Jewish movement that goes back probably 100 years or so, that Reform Jews, I think, are different from the other branches of Judaism in that they feel it's very important to participate in the surrounding community, not to isolate themselves from it, but to be an active part of it. And I think Rabbi Berkowitz did take that point of view very seriously in his own life. I seem to remember just that he was on various commissions, community relations committees and commissions, and I couldn't, quote you the facts. I don't suppose you need me for the facts. I'm sure they're well documented. But I did get the impression that when there were citywide committees or committees among the city clergy, that he quite often would be involved in those.
Check the tape, okay. Do you remember the first time you you met Rabbi Berkowitz?
Well, of course, I had probably met him in a not too meaningful way, just being a member of the temple, going to the temple, greeting him after a service perhaps once in a while. We were not very active, as I said, in temple activities. We did not go to services regularly. For the more important holidays, perhaps he would go. So undoubtedly, I had met him just to say hello or wish him a good Sabbath or whatever it might be. I think probably we got to know him a little bit better when Tony's father died. Tony's parents were still living in Chicago, and he died in Chicago, I think it was December of 75. And Rabbi Berkowitz made a house call here, came to the house to offer condolences to the family. And so that was the first time he had, been in the house, or we had, really met him, I think, outside of the temple and had more of a chance to talk with him. I don't remember too much of what went on there, because, of course, we were upset about the death and, concerned about that. But I do recall that he was a very gracious person. He, I think, was comforting, things that rabbis are supposed to do under such occasions, offered sympathy, and sat and talked for a while and visited. Again, I can't recall what he talked about, probably mainly talking to Tony, since it was her father who died, asking about her father, and that sort of thing. But I never really got to know him on a personal basis. Again, I think probably because our paths didn't really cross too much, because we were not extremely active in the congregation. Probably our children, knew him better, being in the religious school there and having more contact with him. But as I said, I was impressed with his community involvement. I think that was a strong point, and I think maybe more so than a lot of other clergy I've seen and other rabbis that I've seen. I think he did that very well in terms of showing the best of Judaism in terms of how it can help the community, how it can improve the community.
Do you remember anything about the way he ran services at the temple?
Well, again, only to a slight extent, since we were not avid temple goers, and again, as I said, probably being an anti-establishment person myself, whether it was anti-war or anti-religion, I think it was a type of thing where I respected him as a person more so than the job he was doing as a rabbi, because I'm suspicious probably about any rabbi, just somebody who would put himself in a position of telling other people what they should believe or what they should think. And I don't mean that he was doing that. I think some clergy do that. But I think his, he set a good example, which I think is maybe what clergy should do. And in his religious services, the religious part of the service itself, as I said, to me really did not mean much. I tolerated them when I went. I enjoyed the sermons the most. The best part about going to hear any rabbi or any clergyman, even if he's not Jewish, and I've gone to other services as well, Christian services, Catholic or Protestant, is I enjoy sermons. Maybe because they're like university lectures. Being a teacher myself, I can respect the clergyman as a teacher. And I think Rabbi Berkowitz did do that, as I recall. Again, I couldn't quote you specifics or even I don't know if I could even recall a particular sermon that sticks out, but I do seem to recall that at least the sermons were thought-provoking. whatever the topic might be. And even though I might disagree with him, and I often did, I'm sure, especially issues relating to Judaism or Zionism. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Zionist, unlike most Jews in this city, which again puts me at odds with them. Maybe that's part of my anti-establishment. But mm-hmm. again, I think all the support for Israel is much overdone, but and sometimes misdirected. So even if he would give a sermon that I disagreed with,
mm-hmm.
I found it stimulating, and I think that's good. As a scientist, as a chemist, I feel, I like to hear controversial points of view, something that I can argue with. Now, in a sermon, you don't argue directly with the rabbi, mm-hmm. but at least you can then go home, and I can talk to my wife, I can talk to my kids. And one of the benefits of going to services, I found, is that then talking with the family later,
mm-hmm.
I found it was educational to the kids. I'd say to them, well, what do you think of the sermon? You know, you agree or disagree. They would often disagree too, and I would find that I could teach my children my views
mm-hmm.
by having been stimulated by the rabbi's views, whether we agreed or not.
Mm-hmm.
That at least it brought up a topic, it brought up something of interest. And I think that was very helpful.
Was Rabbi Berkowitz a staunch Zionist?
Not as much as some others, I think. Again, I probably couldn't, this is supposed to be history, but I'm sure as a historian you know that what people tell you is their own impressions, mm-hmm. and I am certainly not the historian, so I can't back up with facts what I might mm-hmm. say. He was a Zionist, as I recall. I don't think as staunch, though, as many others.
Mm-hmm.
I think Judaism in general has become much more conservative in recent years, since even Rabbi Berkowitz's time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Jews in the community have become much more Zionistic than they used to be. It's sort of falling back to more of the tradition. I think this idea of the assimilation I was mentioning before, mm-hmm. that traditionally Reform Jews have tried to assimilate in the community, I think that's going back now the other way. And I think what is now a Reform congregation, maybe 20 years ago we would have called that a conservative congregation.
Mm-hmm.
More Hebrew, for example, brought into the services. In those days it was much more English, very little Hebrew. I never studied Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
So to me the Hebrew didn't mean much. In fact, again, it was just sort of a stumbling block and something you tolerate to get to the better stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now you see much more of that, more Hebrew being used, more Zionism. By Zionism, I mean almost like nationalistic support of Israel mm-hmm. and Israeli policies, which I find especially disturbing, considering the Palestinian movement, in the occupied territories opposing Israeli occupation, which I sympathize with to a large extent. I think Jews traditionally have been the underdog, and I think they do much better to support those who need help and,
mm-hmm.
The oppressed people. And here I see the Palestinians as the oppressed and the Israelis as the oppressors, and I think that's very unfortunate, very sad to see Jews in capacity as oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't necessarily follow the Palestinian hard line. I think that's overstated too. I'm perhaps mm-hmm. somewhere in between. I don't think the Palestinians are completely correct either. But I certainly think supporting any government without questioning it, whether it's Israeli or United States government, is a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too many Jews these days are doing that in the case of Israel. That they will support Israel no matter what. They see it as a matter of survival. And to me, I don't. I don't associate Judaism with Israel
mm-hmm.
so much. My ancestors didn't come from Israel, not that anybody can remember. My grandparents came from Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
from Russia, or Poland, or whatever, and not from Israel. So I don't feel that bond
mm-hmm.
that a lot of Jews do. And I don't think Rabbi Berkowitz did either, to the extent that they do nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
I think he supported Israel. He felt it was important that Israel exist. It was certainly important as a homeland after World War II,
mm-hmm.
A place for the Holocaust victims to go, although a lot of them came here too, and everywhere else in the world. And I think there's a feeling that if something like the Holocaust should ever happen again, which we certainly hope it won't, and we should all be making sure it doesn't, but if something like that should happen, I think there's a feeling that there should be a place that Jews can go to and find safety, and I think this might be what a lot of Jews are fearing these days. I don't have that fear myself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's, I think it's being overly paranoid. I think the world is very different now. We have countries like the United States. There are other countries, let's say, where it ought to be safe that hopefully Judaism should not have to depend on Israel as a refuge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it gets to that point, it's probably the end of the world anyway. Nothing much is going to matter. But but again, to summarize, to answer your question, I think, yes, I would say my impression of him was that he was a Zionist, but I think maybe a little more balanced in view and not quite so extreme. That was before the Palestinian issue really came up. I don't think that had come up during his lifetime, where
mm-hmm.
he had the Intifada, where Israel got to the point where it is now, where it has the military power that it does now. That really hadn't, I think, occurred mm-hmm. in his day. Certainly not to the extent that it is now.
Is there anything we haven't touched on that you think we should add, or?
Well, I don't think there's too much else I could really add about the rabbi. One other thing I could mention, though, I think when he was preparing to retire,
mm-hmm.
He chose Rabbi Powers, mm-hmm. his successor, who we like very much as well. I have a lot of respect for Rabbi Powers. Again, contrary to some other members of the congregation who did not like him that much. He was, of course, subsequently replaced. But I knew Rabbi Powers a lot better than Rabbi Berkowitz, but in a way, maybe Rabbi Powers is a reflection of Rabbi Berkowitz, because Berkowitz essentially handpicked him to replace him. And I think, again, he chose a man who was a very intellectual person. He was intellectually challenging. And I think this, to some extent, is what Rabbi Berkowitz was, too. He didn't talk down to the congregation. He raised tough questions. He made them, you know, think about themselves. You know, what are you doing? What's wrong about what you're doing? What's wrong about your views? You know, look at different viewpoints. Challenge. I think a clergyman should challenge his congregation, not to be, you know, let them get too complacent.
Mm-hmm.
Again, maybe that's part of my own political views as a scientist, as somebody who feels politically that there should always be challenges to the establishments, just to keep it on its toes, let's say, just mm-hmm. to have different views being expressed. I think a good rabbi should do that too, and any good clergyman should. Certainly, Rabbi Powers, I recall much better, because we had much more dealing with him, and he was much more involved with the children, but I think he was similar in many ways to Rabbi Berkowitz.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much
okay.
for your time, and